Welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BPSouthside.com, Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on our blog talk radio page by searching for The Catbird Speaks. Joining you today, I'm Colin Whitchurch, co-editor-in-chief of BPSouthside.com, and joining me today is the other co-editor-in-chief, Nick Schaefer. Hey, Nick.
Good afternoon, Colin.
So it's prospect season at BP, and by the time you listen to this podcast, you'll be able to check out the top 10 White Sox prospects. So joining us today is the author of said post, BP senior prospect writer Jeffrey Paternostro. Welcome, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I guess just jumping right into things here, one of the main questions I guess that we had as we look at this list, after all the trades the White Sox made in sending away Chris Sale and Adam Eaton, obviously the top 10 looks a lot different this year as it did last year. But I guess the main question is, do the White Sox have a future rotation here or just a really insane bullpen?
That is a good question. So the problem with we were going through the 101, I probably wrote up 40 or 50 pitchers, four of which are White Sox pitchers. Like, finding the slam dunk starters past, like, the top five or six pitching prospects in the minor leagues right now is pretty difficult. The White Sox ones are particularly difficult because you've got Reynaldo Lopez, who's short. You've got Michael Kopech, who throws allegedly 105, but there might not be much else there. You've got Alec Hansen, who looked to be the number one overall draft pick in, like, February. Sure looked like the number one overall draft pick in September, and in between was terrible, like, as an amateur. So who knows what he is going forward. Carson Fulmer is probably a reliever. Zach Birdie's definitely a reliever. I think Dane Dunning can start, even though he didn't start in college. It's funny because normally you say, oh, this stuff will play itself out over the next couple of years. We'll figure it out. But, I mean, a lot of these guys, like, Lopez is pretty close to major league ready. And he's already pitched in the majors. And Kopech could be major league ready by the end of 2017. So you'd think you have a better feel for what these guys are. And I can't really tell you one way or the other for sure. What I can say is I think we're a little more bullish on Lopez's ability to start than some other sources. I think even if he can't start, he's a potential closer, which is nothing to sneeze at nowadays. I mean, the White Sox certainly have the makings of a, you know, 2015 Kansas City Royals-type bullpen if they want to go in that direction. It's easy to forget that the Royals had many high draft picks in that bullpen when they were dominant. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer. We'll figure it out. I mean, I put it in the hands of Don Cooper and hope for the best. I think you can't really go wrong with that strategy.
Yeah, I one of the things that, and I understand there's all kinds of questions that, different concerns you have to weigh in terms of proximity to the majors and higher floor versus ceiling and ability to start versus relief and all that. I was interested to see Hansen ahead of the trio of Dunning, Birdie, and Fulmer. Does that reflect a greater confidence in his ability to be an impact starter than those guys behind him?
I think so. It really comes down to looking at those set of names in the back half of the top 10. It's, you know, you want to chase ceiling a little bit there, I think. And at that point in the list, even though Hansen, again, as I said, he's a tough guy to get a handle on. I talked to someone that saw him as an amateur and did not write him up well at all because he looked like a third round pick, you know, just, it wasn't there based on sort of the pre-junior season scouting reports. But then we had guys that saw him post signing and it looked like, yeah, this looks like one of the best amateur pitchers in the draft class this year. So how do you want to weight that? He did make our 101 towards the back end. But, you know, normally guys in that, you see pitchers at that end, you're like, they're guys that are like maybe more sure shot relievers, or they're, you know, mid rotation guys with injury issues, like David Paulino of the Astros is in that general vicinity as well. Hansen's kind of a little bit of a, I guess the closest comp is another guy that made the 101 is Walker Buehler of the Dodgers. Was another guy that had huge helium going into his draft year, but he needed Tommy John surgery, which is a different thing, but it's the same kind of sort of uncertainty going forward. But what we saw, you know, as a staff at the end of the 2016 season from both of them made us confident enough to put him on the 101, just because at that point in the list, you know, bet on the guy that might be an impact starter someday.
Yeah, if memory serves, Buehler, I think Buehler was in that Vanderbilt rotation with Fulmer. And then he, when he came back from Tommy John at the end of last year, he threw, what, 10 innings, but he was throwing, like, crazy velocity.
Yeah, it was like 90, it was like three-inning bursts, and it was like 97, which, and he's another guy that doesn't have a traditional starter's frame. So, yeah, maybe going forward he's a reliever, who knows. You know, Hansen certainly has the tools to start. It's just, it wasn't all quite there for him this year in college. You know, he's a big, tall pitcher, so there can be, you know, some stuff to smooth out there going forward as well. And it's, again, it's not a huge sample size, talking about, you know, 50 or so professional innings at this point. But, you know, the stuff's the stuff, and it's top of the rotation stuff if he can sort of put it all together going forward. You know, if we were more confident in that, he'd be more in sort of like the Riley Pint, AJ Puck range. We're not sure yet, so he's a little bit further down.
I think that makes sense. Pivoting back up towards the top of the list where you have, BP as a whole, you guys have Giolito as the number one pitching prospect here. And I know different outlets have basically like shuffled these top guys around a lot. I think Law had Kopech at the top of the pitchers in this group. But I've seen a lot of conversation about Giolito's spin rate on his fastball. People seem all over the place on Giolito. Do you have any particular, I don't know, strong feelings about his prognosis moving forward?
I don't. If I did, I'd have a different job than the one I have, I'm pretty sure. So you can explain away Giolito's 2016 season pretty easily. The Nationals played with his mechanics early in the season, which caused him to lose velocity and a little bit of command. He was kind of working his way back to his old mechanics by the end of the year. Didn't quite get it all the way, you know, back to where he was as a prospect in years past. But, you know, the top of the rotation stuff still in there somewhere. Now, the problem with Giolito is, and again, we have him ranked very highly because at a certain point, I've got to go off the reports that we have, and the reports we have, you know, coming into the season were pretty good, and that's still a pitcher that I think probably exists, is that he's never really come and just dominated a level, really since about A-ball at this point. He has the stuff to do it. You know, the fastball can run up to around 98 when he's going good. The curve is a potential monster. It's just not a pitch he commands really well. And you saw that in the majors, I think, was the main issue. He couldn't really command the curve well enough to get guys to chase it. He couldn't start it in the zone, so we had to go back to the fastball. And, you know, when it's 93, 94 mile an hour fastball, that, again, he's not commanding great because he's playing with his mechanics. Major league hitters are going to hit that, and they did. Again, is this just like, I don't want to hand wave like, oh, Don Cooper will teach him a slider, and next thing you know, he'll be a top of the rotation starter. There was always a chance, you know, going back to sort of the bullpen conversation, that he would just be a really good closer someday, which is, you know, again, a guy that had 1-1 hype coming into his senior season in high school. Is that a great outcome? I mean, I guess not, but pitchers are weird, man. They're very volatile. Would I be surprised if Giolito comes out next year in Charlotte and shoves for 3 months and looks like a top-of-the-rotation starter and we go from there? Not at all. Would I be surprised if there's still some mechanical things to work through and he ends up being a really good reliever by the end of the year? No. Would I be surprised if he blows out again? No. It's a pitcher. And, again, this is sort of the same idea as what we just talked about with Hansen. Eventually, you just want to bet on the upside. And if he does put it back together, suddenly you have a top-of-the-rotation righty with a 70 or 80 grade fastball.
So the top 10 list is obviously littered with pitchers, as one would expect, and you have Yoan Moncada up at number one. The guy that I'm most curious about, who seems to generate a lot of conversations, is right smack dab in the middle of all those pitchers. You have Zach Collins at number five, who, from everything I've read, is someone whose bat everyone is very high on, but nobody knows if he can catch. Can he catch?
So, in the process of doing the 101 list, I like back check it with various, you know, team and professional sources just to you know, just to get a feel for where I am in line or out of line with the industry. Not that necessarily is going to make me change things drastically, but just to sort of get my bearings. And Zach Collins came up a lot and bounced around a lot in our one-on-one discussions. I will say it was very difficult to find someone that thought he could stick a catcher long term.
You didn't talk to anyone in the White Sox organization.
I did find one eventually, but they thought we actually ended up having him too low because of that, I'm assuming. But
yeah, that's been the especially the White Sox Fan Fest was recently, yeah. And the company line is very bullish on.
Sure.
But obviously, they have an incentive to be optimistic there.
And look, you can, to a certain extent, receiving is a teachable skill. A lot of teams have done well with it. It's not like your arm strength is your arm strength, and really his arm strength isn't an issue. You know, he's not the most athletic catcher. And the interesting thing to me, I think, was the Angels taking Matt Thaiss and immediately moving him to first base when he probably had a better chance to catch than Collins did. It wasn't a lock, and his bat's not as good as Collins. And look, if Collins is the first baseman, you know, it's not impossible that he has a good major league career. Obviously, you want the 25 home run hitting catcher whenever you can get him. But, you know, he's going to catch until he can't. And that's another thing where I think I've written about this at BP this year. Is like, I'm not great at evaluating catcher defense because it's very difficult to do from my vantage point. And there's so much other stuff that goes into it that I'm just not privy to. You know, some of the work that Jonathan Judge and Harry Pavlidis have done at BP on game calling and stuff like that. You can, like, I can run a stopwatch. I can tell you Zach Collins is throwing, whatever, 1.95 home to second, and that's fine. But, you know, sort of really seeing how he handles a professional pitching staff, because I don't know the ins and outs of the University of Miami, but I imagine the game was called from the bench. And even if you can teach the receiving, there's the other soft skills in there too. But I'm just sort of telling you what the reflection of the industry was, which was it's tough to find someone that thinks Zach Collins can catch long term.
Yeah, and I suppose this list and a lot of the questions we're asking you, these seem to be the, maybe Moncada aside, these are all classic profiles where it's like the devil of prospecting, right? Where you're trying to decide, okay, are these guys, like you were saying, how many times have you bitten up? You know, how's his command and his feel for a change going to develop? We'll see. Is he a starter reliever? We'll see. And, you know, catcher defense, I feel like, falls into one of those classic buckets where, like you said, there's some mutability there where the example I've given on this was Tyler Flowers was a White Sox catching prospect who, when he was acquired, what I remember reading everywhere was, well, his bat is definitely going to play anywhere, but he's probably not a catcher. And then fast forward to him being basically a glove only catcher.
That happens a lot,
which is bizarre. But that's not to say that will happen for Collins, but I guess it is sort of, it is the question with Collins, but it's also almost unfair to ask, like, is he going to catch? Because shrug emoji, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to make a call. Like, I'm writing a list, and one of the jobs involved in writing these kind of lists is you got to make a decision. I can change it next year if I really want to, and if things change, which they will. But it's just it's tricky with catchers. And especially with sort of the changing viewpoints around baseball are with regards to receiving being sort of the new desired skill. If you do think you can teach it, and I'm sure it's teachable. I don't know if it's teachable to everyone, obviously. It is just funny to see all these guys, like Carson Kelly's another guy sort of in the same general range as Collins, who's gone through that. He's already he's major league ready, got some major league time this year, but he's gone from, you know, maybe a prep arm to a bat first third baseman that couldn't hit to a great catcher that couldn't hit to a catcher that, oh, I think we can hit now. catchers are weird. Kevin Plawecki is another one like this that sort of had that, it's a fringy catcher glove, but we think he'll hit. You know, he's got great bat to ball, and now he's like a 220 hitting framing god.
So I guess changing gears here, one of the guys that we kind of skipped over at the beginning is the obvious number one, the guy oozing with potential, Yoan Moncada. And I guess it's because we don't have a lot of questions about his chances of making the majors. But I guess one of the main questions that surrounds him is where he's going to play defensively. I've seen second base. I've seen third base. People have said that he could maybe play center field if necessary. Do you have any sort of opinion on where you think he'll end up in the majors?
I think he probably is best off playing second. And he's in an organization now that will allow for that. He's had like 2 weeks at third base, so I don't want to say he can't play third. But the reports, early reports were mixed on that. And I guess you probably might, I think it's sort of the speed, range stuff plays a little better at second because his hands and actions are just okay. And his arm can be a little scattershot, although it's strong. I don't think he's a center fielder. He's very, I mean, he's right now, he's a plus-plus runner, but he's never played any outfield. And as much as speed can cover for a multitude of sins, I just think throwing him in the outfield is probably not the best idea in the world, especially if he can stick on the dirt, which I think he can. I don't think he's going to win gold gloves there. But again, the general, going back to sort of the industry consensus on Moncada, and we saw him plenty of times this year too, is that he'll be fine there. Like, he's not going to win a gold glove. He'll be average, maybe a little bit above. And then you just let the bat do its thing.
Yeah, to that end, I know certainly White Sox fans kind of cringe when you hear this guy just needs to get his strikeouts under control, get his bat-to-ball skills improved to unlock his potential because, you know, there hasn't been a ton of position player talent coming through the system, but the White Sox have development on that front has been poor for quite some time. So, I know, especially given his very, very limited major league debut last year where he struck out like crazy, do you think this is cause for terror or just careful monitoring?
I'll say this. We had him outside of the top 10 on our 101, and that was me pushing it, and I got talked out of it. I mean, the talent's obvious. I will say of the top maybe 25 non-position player or non-pitching prospects, so the top 25, just looking at the position players, I think the guy most likely to bust is probably Moncada. I don't think it's hugely high, but he's risky. It's the kind of thing where the strikeouts could really sap the value if he's, you know, and make him a 240 or 250 hitter. Now there's enough power speed there that probably makes him still a major league regular. It doesn't make him a ton more than that. But it's just, to be fair, they jumped him over AAA. He didn't have much time at AA when they dumped him in the majors, and they dumped him in a pennant race, and they didn't stick with him. I don't want to read too much into that, but I think going back to sort of the underlying risks in the profile, generally, it's something to, it's a cause for, it's something worth keeping an eye on, at least. See how he does in sort of a more full look at AA this year.
And looking at your write-up on him, something that doesn't always make it into, I guess, sort of a quote-unquote, you know, scouting profile, you guys touched on the fact that he has a good idea of what he wants to do at the plate and recognizes pitches well. So having that eye, is the issue with strikeouts, does that stem from, is that a mechanical issue?
He swings hard.
Okay.
Is basically what it comes down to. And when he makes contact, it goes a long way. And that's from both sides of the plate. But, yeah, it's like anything else. Being able to recognize spin is great. Being able to adjust the spin and being able to adjust a better spin in hitters' counts. That's something I think you see a lot at AA, is guys in A-ball, advanced A, when they're up 2-0, they're going to get a fastball. Because very, very few pitchers at that level are confident enough to throw their off-speed when they're behind. You get a double A, there's a whole, like, all those pitchers that you didn't, that could do it in A ball, they all made it to double A. And now you're seeing them, and even really good hitting prospects with good bat to ball, all of a sudden, it takes a while to adjust to that mentality where all of a sudden you might see a 2-0 or 2-1 changeup and you're front footed on it. I mean, he's never going to be Tony Gwynn, is the thing.
Got it.
If he's going to strike out 150 times a year, that's fine. He has enough power and he makes enough hard contact that he could still hit 280 with 25 home runs doing that and playing second base. He got some seasons that are better than that. I like Moncada a lot. Even when I say, well, I had him outside of the top 10, that's still one of the 10 or 15 best prospects in baseball right now. So I don't want to sort of overplay the concerns in the profile either. I think he's a really good prospect, just maybe a bit riskier than you would expect to see for a guy in that general range of a top 101 list.
And I guess that's kind of what can happen at the top, especially when you're talking about these global top 25, top 30 guys, where it's a given when you put him that high that it's like, okay, we're clearly expressing that this guy's really good, and it's more productive to talk about the reasons why they might fail rather than the obvious reasons why they might succeed. And I think I was running into this a little bit too when I was doing the write-up for someone like Rodon for the under 25 portion of this article, where I was thinking about it, and he went from, because of how hyped he was going into his final year of college, that when he underperformed, all of a sudden it became, how is this guy doing relative to our expectations for him coming into the year? And all of a sudden the narrative is, well, he's a disappointment and he's failing. And similarly, he was in the minors for such a brief period of time, and he's been learning in the majors. He didn't really get a chance to, you know, build up that sort of, I don't know, prospect shine, if that makes any sense. Like, we didn't spend multiple years thinking, oh man, look at this guy eviscerating the minor leagues. Can't wait to see him in the majors. So it can be, I guess it's easy to fall into a trap of saying, yeah, this is the path of how Moncada would bust, and letting that overwhelm the fact that he is still a freak athlete with a lot going for him. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's like, even the guys we have ahead of him, like, you know, Andrew Benintendi might just be a decent corner outfielder at the end of the day.
Right.
Since the really offensive bar is so high there. But yeah, it's just, and he's like, maybe J.P. Crawford hits 250 in the majors. I think he hits better than that. But maybe he's just, maybe he's closer to Alcides Escobar as a player than Francisco Lindor. You know, I know it's, until you do it in the majors, and I guess you can maybe give a little more credit for Benintendi, Swanson, and Alex Reyes, sort of the top, on sort of the top level elite prospect, because they have done it in the majors, even in a small sample size. Gives you a little more confidence in them going forward than even someone like Moncada. Now, Moncada probably has more, well, maybe not more upside than Reyes, but more upside than Benintendi and Swanson. It's just a matter of, can he get there?
Yeah, and that was something we talked a little bit about this right before we started recording, where that was part of, I was thinking about that when I put Anderson ahead of Moncada in the under 25. Granted, I've had the ability to watch a bunch of Anderson, and then Moncada, it's more been just reading what others have seen. But just the fact that Anderson was adequate at the plate and played a pretty good shortstop was enough for me to say, well, this is, you know, he's proven he can at least put his bat on major league pitching. With the obvious, it seems that Moncada's ceiling is much, much higher than Anderson's, but just that demonstrated ability at the major league level was enough for me to make that decision. I could probably talk myself into one way or the other for days, but that's how I came down on it.
Sure, and you say that, but you know, it's the same thing with Tim Anderson. If he could just cut his strikeout rate a little bit, all of a sudden, is his ceiling really that much lower than Moncada? It's not a wildly dissimilar skill set. I think Moncada's a little more raw power, but you know, Anderson has the ability to play up the middle, whether it's shortstop, which it looks like it certainly could be, or you know, plenty of scouts have said he might have to move to center, where I think it would be good as well. But I don't know if I would have done it, but I think it's a perfectly justifiable decision, because that major league performance does matter. That's the end goal here.
I do find that reassuring, because it could look silly. I mean, Anderson could come out next
sure.
year.
Dude, you're talking to a guy that just published a 101 prospect list. It's going to make him look silly multiple times over the next 12 months. So you got to embrace that.
Are there, I guess, moving to the, just looking quickly at the, like the back half of the top 10, or looking even outside the top 10, is there anybody that you're, fond of particularly, or think, hey, maybe this is a guy further down on the list or even outside of the top 10?
I kind of like Dane Dunning. He's another one with a little bit of a weird profile because he wasn't starting because the Florida rotation was so deep. And he's, again, not anything that's going to wow you stuff-wise, but he's a bit of a bulldog. I think he can move fairly quickly through the minors and be that kind of, like, back-end starter for the White Sox within a couple years. Basabe, I just don't know if he's going to hit. Like, he's another guy where it's... he's, like, the tools aren't quite on Moncada's level, but there is some fun speed-power stuff there. And he could be a pretty good center fielder. But, again, it's just, like... I'm just going to dart at the board in terms of whether or not he can hit major league pitching at this point.
Yeah, I think at least when White Sox fans first saw him in the trade return, people were saying, oh, well, so he's basically the Adam Engel, Jacob May center fielder whose bat is a huge question mark. But I think Basabe is clearly from a cut above within that phylum of player in terms of quality at this stage. In terms of, I guess, the offseason started with the huge returns for Eaton and Sale, and then it's been absolutely silent in terms of being able to actually bring anything back. I mean, do you have any opinion on, apparently the White Sox went to Houston and said that they could have Quintana for Martes, Tucker, and Musgrove. Did you have any reactions to that proposal? Or
I mean, that's not – I don't think it's wildly unreasonable. I think it's – I'm not a big Joe Musgrove guy, which might make it seem more reasonable for me than others. But, you know, Martes, another one of those guys with better stuff than your – we're not sure if he's a mid-rotation starter or reliever in the end guy. Tucker, everyone thinks he's going to hit for power. He hasn't yet. But man, everyone thinks he's going to hit for power. And we had to sort of rank him off that. So you're getting, again, sort of probably two top 50-ish type prospects. Plus Musgrove is basically a major league ready for Quintana. That seems like a fair return to me.
Yeah, I mean, I've been...
I mean, I understand why Houston's not going to do it, sort of. Though it's not really the kind of thing that's going to impact their sort of 2017-2018 teams. But their system's like a little shallow right now. So they'd be selling off their two best prospects. And they haven't shown a particular inclination to go out and sort of spend on the free agent market sort of commensurate with their market size.
It's interesting because they seem to have, you know, if they have Quintana, it seems like they have a pretty clear championship caliber contender put together right now. And yeah. Then I guess it's a question of whether you think
they always seem to be a little hesitant to get that last piece, though. I think that was true going into last year too.
Yeah, and it definitely, you know, when as soon as Keuchel and McHugh took a step back, that was enough to keep him out of the playoffs.
Yeah, I don't know what I don't always know what they're thinking. I'll put it that way.
Colin, did you have anything else you wanted to ask Jeff while we have him?
You know, I feel like we've touched on all the questions that we discussed. I mean, I guess I'm more curious. You mentioned Dunning as far as kind of a lower down guy. Is there anyone outside of the top 10? I haven't seen your write-up of the other guys in the system yet, but is there anyone intriguing? It seems a lot of what I've read ever since the trades were made about for Sale and Eaton is that while the system is obviously improved, and it is improved.
Yeah, there's really no one. The funny thing is, like, we were putting the list together, which is very easy because we'd obviously written up most of these guys before the trade already, and then I'm like, all right, here's the top 10. I'm like, I don't like anyone after this. I mean, it literally was when I was putting together org rankings for the book early December before the trade happened, and thank God they actually got the deals done before I submitted that for the annual. It would look more out of date than it is, and it's a little bit out of date because there have been some smaller moves since then across baseball. But like, I had them. I didn't like. So there's, for me, there's like the four clear terrible systems right now, which is Anaheim, the Marlins, Diamondbacks, and the Royals. And then there's that next tier of like the Tigers, the Orioles, the Mariners, and the White Sox were in that one, where it's just like sort of like a generically bad system. Like, it could be just a bad system, it could just be a down year, but like sort of the regular, like acceptably bad, I guess, not long term, but like acceptably bad. Like, those other four systems are just like, what am I writing? Like, I can't even do this. And they moved up to a top five system off that, because I do, you know, my philosophy is I want to wait the best prospects you have, so to speak. I want to wait the top, maybe not just strictly top 100 guys, but, you know, maybe the top 150 or 200 prospects in baseball. And I think, you know, even down to probably Birdie and Dunning, those are guys that would make that kind of a list. And that's pretty good. Like, it's cool that the Yankees' 31st best prospect is like Kyle Higashioka or something, and is probably going to be a major league backup catcher for a while. But that's not a huge deal for me compared to the fact that, oh, the Yankees have like eight top 101 guys and 20 guys that are going to be probably major league contributors of some sort. You know, that's the kind of stuff I really want to look for. And the White Sox have those that high upside talent now, up and down the top 10 at least.
It is funny how it shook out, where, you know, people do top 10s just because it's a nice clean number and 10 is,
yeah,
you know, 10 presents well. But then the White Sox totally coincidentally seem to have their system matching up with that arbitrary.
No, perfect.
So it may deceptively make the, because I know for some other org rankings, they had the White Sox a little lower based on the fact that it's like, yeah, this top 10 looks great, and then there's not much else here. So it sounds like your philosophy is to wait that top 10 significantly more. And that makes sense to me. But
right. Cause it's harder to get, you know, look at what it costs to get Giolito, Lopez, and Dunning, the amount of talent had to go in the other direction. It's tough to get those guys into your system any other way. You know, it's not hard to find the, you know, a fifth infielder that might be the 16th best prospect in the White Sox system. You know, you can get that guy on a non-roster invite sometimes. You can get maybe a little better proven one for $3 or $4 million a year on the free agent market as well. And again, it's nice to develop those guys internally. I think it makes things a little bit easier for you, but I don't think in terms of like looking at the health of the organization, if the White Sox are a playoff contender within the next 2 to 3 years, it's not going to be because like Micker Adolfo took a step forward.
Fair enough. I think you're coming. Is the end in sight for you? I know you've been doing prospects like 20 hours a day
last
like
week. Got
so
three
is there
teams left? So I don't know. The White Sox done. It's only two. So
I'll certainly plug the For All You Kids Out There podcast. Even as someone who's not a Mets fan, I listen to that regularly. Even as someone who's not a wrestling fan, I listen to that regularly. But I think Colin is a wrestling fan, so maybe that's – I can certainly nudge you in that direction, Colin. But
yes, for sure. It's a good podcast. I've listened to it. I recommend it as well.
Is there anything else you wanted to point out for our the White Sox fan base here before we let you go?
I mean, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Jeff Paternostro, and you should definitely buy the annual, which has these White Sox prospects in it and a whole lot more.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for your time on
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
No, thanks for having me. Anytime.